Welcome to the Casey Cowers Show, a celebration of words. I'm Chuck Atkins, the show's producer. You're in for a real holiday treat the next 2 weeks. The interview you're about to hear took place on November 9th, 2004, at the home of Horton Foote. Mr. Foote was born in Wharton, Texas on March 14th, 1916. He is best known for his Academy Award-winning screenplays. His first Academy Award was for the screenplay To Kill a Mockingbird, which he wrote in 1962. His second was for Tender Mercies, which he won in 1983. Mr. Foote was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in 1995 for his play The Young Man from Atlanta. He was 79 when he won his Pulitzer Prize. Part one of this interview focuses on Tender Mercies and Trip to Bountiful. So sit back and enjoy yourself as Casey talks to one of our national treasures.
Welcome to the Casey Cowar Show, a celebration of words. Today I'm honored to have as our guest Mr. Horton Foote. And I can't tell you how thrilled I am to be talking to Mr. Foote, because I believe that the body of work that Mr. Foote has created stands among the finest written in the American theater as well as in films. So what we're going to do as normal, we're going to just talk about Mr. Foote's writing. We're going to talk about some of the films and the plays he's written and about the craft of writing. And first of all, I would just like to introduce you. And Mr. Foote, thank you very much for appearing on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
And Mr. Foote probably doesn't remember this, but it was about 8 or 9 years ago, and we were at the Suwanee Writers Conference, which is a place that we both hold dear to our hearts. And he gave a lecture on the American theater about how people had always come up to him and asked, how do you do this? Or he had started out by asking people, how do you do this? And then he had reached a point in his career where people were asking him, how do you do this? And I had cornered him afterwards, and I told him, I said, Mr. Foote, I said, I think Tender Mercies is perhaps the finest screenplay that I've ever read, in one of my favorite movies. And we sat and chatted for a moment. And if we could start off talking about Tender Mercies just a bit, because one of the things I love about Tender Mercies is not only the beauty of the screenplay, but Robert Duvall, the character who is such an important character in so much of your work. And in Tender Mercies, how did that take place in terms of when you wrote the screenplay and when Mr. Duvall got involved?
Well, I finished the screenplay, and I called Bobby up because we'd worked together, you know, many times, and said I had a screenplay that I think he should consider, and that I wasn't living in New York then. I was living in New Hampshire, but I'd taken an apartment in New York for occasional visits. So I met him there, and my daughter Hallie was with me, and she was friendly with Bob and also with the young woman that he was dating at the time. And Hallie had told me that he could sing. I hadn't realized that. And so we arrived in the apartment, and Bob and Gail came, and I said, I'm going to read this to you. And I think that was a shock to him, because I think he thought he would have the luxury and really of taking it away and reading it and making up his mind. And I'm sure he thought, what am I going to do if I don't like it?
Sure.
But fortunately, he liked it. And that was the beginning of a long journey, because we didn't have an easy time getting it done. We had hoped to co-produce it ourselves, but we didn't get very far with that. And then Bob never got discouraged. I a couple of times thought, well, you know, there's just no point in trying to fight this green, this Hollywood culture, because it's they just didn't see it at all. And there was only one American director, actually, that was interested, and Bob didn't like him, so that ruled that out. But I sent it to friends of mine, and Arthur Penn was a very close friend of mine, and Dan Petrie, and Velvet Man, and they just didn't react. In all fairness, I think Arthur Penn liked it very much, but he was interested in a more kind of theatrical, overt kind of violence. So they called up and said that they had I seen Break a Morant, which was a film by an Australian director, a young great director. And I said, no, I hadn't, and I went to see it, and I liked it a lot. But when they told me they were sending the script to him, I thought, they're really out of their mind. I mean, an Australian who knows nothing about culture, really, I thought foolishly, what in the world is he going to make of this? But they didn't listen to me, fortunately, and they sent it to him, and lo and behold, word came back that he was coming to America, and if he could get along with me, he wanted to do the film. And we did get along, and Bruce told me later that he only read half of it, and he was so excited and so afraid that somebody in America was going to take the job that he went running to the phone. And little did he know that it had been turned down by a vast board of directors. And, you know, it was one of those things. I never can explain certain things, how they work out. Makes you humble, because it was the last thing I could have imagined for the film. And probably one of the great blessings, because he really loved it and understood it. And found a real style for it, I think, a way of telling it. And so it was a very happy time.
There's a particular scene in Tender Mercies, which I think is one of the most powerful scenes in film. And it's when Robert Duvall's character, Max Ledge, has found out that his daughter has been killed in an accident. And there's a line in there, and he says, happiness, I've never trusted it, and I never
I don't trust it. Happiness. I never have, and never will.
Yeah. And as a writer, when you write a line like that, do you realize sometimes that you've written something that's that's extraordinary?
I certainly have learned that it's the line that many people retain. And I have to say this. I mean, I think it's a lovely scene, and I'm very moved by it. But I have to give both Bruce and Bob credit here. First of all, Bruce was so anxious that the studio was not fooled around with that scene that he did it in one take.
Yeah.
And he did it away from this, so you got the whole thing. But there was no stopping it, there was no going for close-ups. One take, and he said, let's go. Which was extraordinary. And I think it's that utter simplicity that gives it the power.
Now, and didn't I also read that they did want, there was some talk of having a love interest between Robert Duvall's character and Dixie, his wife, who was a singer, at one point, didn't they want them to have some kind of a reunion? Was that never discussed?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay.
I would have said no anyway. So.
Okay, good. And another thing I love about Tender Mercies is at the end of the movie when Bob and the young boy are just throwing the football.
Yeah.
There's just something wonderfully simple, something healing about that.
Yeah.
That he's been able, that they've been able to overcome these things.
Yeah.
And now, Bob also sang World War I songs.
In 1918. Yeah.
And I think Willie Nelson sang
the
other,
right.
Didn't he?
That was a gift of friendship.
That was a friendship?
was a gift of friendship.
Yeah.
And I forget how Willie got involved. I think the man that was scoring the film was a friend of his. And then Willie Nelson was very admiring of Tender Mercies, and I think he and Bob had some kind of, I don't know how deep a friendship,
yeah,
but he had a friendship. And so I think Bob was thrilled to sing with him.
Oh, yeah, I bet. Yeah. Well, let's move on to tomorrow, to the William Faulkner story, which you wrote the screenplay for and produced. And was it 1971 was when that was released?
Well, it was, you know, it had a, Tomorrow had a long history. It was first done on Playhouse 90.
Okay.
With Kim Stanley and Richard Boone.
Okay.
And then Herbert Berghoff had a little theater on Bank Street. And he loved the Tomorrow. And he called me and he said, would you consider doing it as a play? And I said, yes, but who in the world are we going to get to play Max Ledge? And he said, what about Bob DeVal? And I thought, I never would have thought of it, but of course I would think it would be remarkable if he'd do it. Well, he not only did it, he loved it. And the woman playing his, turns out to be in the course of the story, she becomes his wife, Olga Bellet,
mm-hmm,
was married to Paul Robley, who was the grandson of the Robley that built the Brooklyn Bridge.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And was enormously wealthy.
Okay.
And so he wanted to do it as a film. And he put up most of it with his own money.
Okay.
I think we did it for $400,000.
Wow.
And the one difficult part of it was that he didn't want Herbert to direct it, because Herbert was German and English was not a helpful language for him.
Okay.
And he was afraid that he'd never done a film that might miss him. So I was quite torn because I owed Herbert a great debt of gratitude and also we were very close, and but he chose to seek out another close friend of mine, Joseph Anthony, to direct it. Well, Joe had seen it and he was smart enough that he really, most of the pattern, the acting pattern was set by Herbert.
Yeah.
And Joe was smart enough not to fool with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he added some quite remarkable things himself. Little things like that lovely moment when she's bathing herself by the window and hearing the sunshine.
Yes.
That was Joe. And but the two actors had been in Herbert's production, so the performances remained pretty much the same.
Yeah. For any of our listeners that have not seen Tomorrow, I strongly, highly recommend that you see it, because there are some stunning performances, and it's just a beautiful story, beautifully acted, and I think it has just a very, very powerful ending. And kind of set, was almost like a predecessor for some of the things that Robert Duvall did down the road as an actor. I think he's always been willing to take a risk of.
Yes, he's a big risk taker. The thing that's interesting about it, too, from my point of view, is I had done the year before Faulkner's The Old Man.
Yes.
Which had had a great success, and I think they'd shown it four times or something. So they sent me this, and I was looking forward to it, but when I got it and read it, I didn't like it. I liked it, but I didn't know how in the world to do it. And because in the story, do you know the story?
Oh, yes.
There's only about two paragraphs about this woman. They don't even name her, and they say she's dark-complected, mm-hmm, and every actress that's played it has been blonde. But anyway, I was walking around, I lived on the banks of the Hudson River then, walking around at night, just wondering how in the world I could do this and if I should do it. And all of a sudden I thought, well, I began to think about this woman. Mm-hmm. And I gave her a name, Sarah Eubanks. Mm-hmm. And I just became fascinated with her. So I thought, I'm breaking up something that I rarely do. I'm going to really, in a sense, redo at least half of Faulkner's work here. And I didn't know how he would take it, you know, whether I didn't know him, but I knew he had sent word that he liked Old Man very much. Mm-hmm. And anyway, I thought, well, I have nothing to lose, because if the studio doesn't want to do it, then that's fine. Well, that's really how it started, how I got into the story, was imagining her and her circumstances, and how she got there. And of course, she is almost half of the film now. And in some ways, I think it's the most powerful part of the film.
And so Faulkner liked the revisions and was...
Well, I never knew that he did. I mean, he did like it. I heard from his agent, but he did also a very kind thing, because it is published as a play, and it can be done as a play. Or I guess it could be done again as a film, although I wouldn't really want to do that, but a couple of people have come to me about it. But he's allowed me to share half the theatrical copyright.
Wasn't that nice?
I've never heard of it before.
No.
So... Because that pleased me very much.
Sure, absolutely. Let's talk about the trip to Bountiful. That was, I believe, that was one of the first pieces that you wrote, or it was written, was around 1953 or something like that. Was it written for the television originally?
It was written for what we call live television.
Live television.
There was no way really to successfully record it. I mean, the Kinney scopes is what they used then, and they disintegrate finally.
Okay.
So it was much nearer theater. In other words, you couldn't stop it.
Right.
And if an actress went up in lines, you couldn't prompt them.
Okay.
And if you prompted them, be like you prompted them in the theater. And the audience could hear it, and that they didn't want the television.
Right, right.
It only happened once in a show of mine. It was one that Dorothy Gish was in called The Oil Well. And she was a very nervous lady, a very sweet lady, but very nervous. And I think she was terrified just what happened to her. And it did. It seemed like, I'm sure, a half hour, but it wasn't more than a couple of seconds.
Yeah.
She recovered.
So when the trip to Bountiful, when the film was made with Geraldine Page, who won the Academy Award for it, and just a beautiful movie, were you happy with the way that all ended up playing out with?
Yeah, I was happy, because it was interesting. Again, I'm always humble, because I had about 10 or 12 chances to make that film before.
Okay.
But Lillian Gish did it originally, and she was extraordinary.
Yes.
And Hollywood didn't think she was bankable. But I turned down all kinds of people, like not Betty Davis, because no one ever thought of her, but Katharine Hepburn, I think they thought of, and they came to me with all these people.
Uh-huh.
And I just said no.
Yeah.
And then Lillian hit 90. And I thought, well, that really is not... Although, when Pete Maston came to me to do it, and he said, what about Lillian Gish? And I said, oh, no. I said, she's just too old. And he said, what if we ask her? I said, no, don't ask her. She'll say yes. And so that's why we didn't use Lillian. She was still living. And it always upset me terribly, but I just felt it would be wrong, because actually, the real Mrs. Watts is only in her late 50s.
Mm-hmm.
But in those days, that seemed old, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and it was, she aged because of her kind of life she lived. She worked hard in the fields, and she, you know.
Yes.
But it wasn't the accumulation of years that did it to her.
Yeah.
So, and I know Lillian saw it, I'm sure, but she never got in touch with me. And then soon after that, she didn't remember anything. So.
Okay.
I guess she forgot that too.
Okay. Okay.
But, so then Pete asked me who I wanted, and I said, Geraldine Page.
Sure.
And he said, that's who I would like to. I said, well, we're in business.
Yeah. That's a beautiful movie. I mean, it really is. It just, and I thought Rebecca De Bornay was very good.
Yes, she was.
In that movie.
Yeah.
And there's just some very kind people in there.
Yeah.
I think there are a lot of people that do want to just go home and see their home one more time. And, just a beautiful, beautiful story.
Yeah. But we just had the film, the play is 50 years old now.
50 years old.
And we just had two or three productions, a small tour around America.
Okay.
With it.
Thank you for listening to part one of Casey's interview with Horton Foote. Please be sure to join us next week when Mr. Foote talks about writing the screenplay for the classic film To Kill a Mockingbird, and discusses the importance Gregory Peck had in the final release of the film. Mr. Foote will also discuss winning the Pulitzer Prize and his current works in progress. You won't want to miss it. This is Chuck Atkins, the editor of the show, inviting you back next week. Thanks for listening.